This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Cynthia Greenlee Donnell is a graduate student in American history at Duke, and she recently got a call from the producers at the PBS show History Detectives. The show wanted her to help trace the life of an enslaved girl named Willoughby, and all they had was a bill of sale dated to 1829. Turns out Willoughby's tale unfolded near Cynthia's mother's hometown in South Carolina, and that realization turned a historical search into a personal exploration. The program airs tonight at 8 o'clock. Cynthia Greenlee Donnell is with me right now in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Frank.
Tell me about that phone call you got from History Detectives. What'd they want?
Well, they had gotten my name from a South Carolina historian. They wanted someone to help give them historical context about this document, which was a bill of sale for a young enslaved woman. She was 17 years old, and her name was Willoughby, and she had been sold in the Charleston district to a man named James P. Daniels, and they wanted somebody to help put flesh kind of on the bones of that history. And they called me, not because I'm a historian of slavery, even though I do study girlhood in the 19th century. They called me because this historian said, look up this graduate student because her family's from this area. And so I wasn't particularly excited, actually, about helping out in the beginning because it wasn't really my area. I do the late 19th century rather than the early part of the 19th century. But I got intrigued because over phone conversations with the producers of the show, they told me that the slave owner's name, his last name was Daniels, and that was my mother's maiden name. And so the wheels started turning, and I started to think, this is a really small area. Even today, my mother's hometown has 6,000 people. So I thought, I wonder if there's a connection. And we started looking for Willoughby, but we also started looking for my family as well.
And what did you find? Did you find a connection?
Well, we did find a connection. So first we found Willoughby. This collector wanted to know what happened to Willoughby after 1829 because the bill of sale essentially was a receipt, and we didn't know anything else about Willoughby. Did she survive slavery? Did she have a family of her own? And we wanted to advance her story. So we realized when we did a little bit more research that Willoughby was enslaved on the exact same plantation that my great-great-grandfather was enslaved on, and his name was Moses or Mose. And so we knew that Willoughby most certainly would have known him. And after slavery, they were in close proximity to each other. If you look at some census pages, which are on the History Detective's website, you can see that Willoughby and Moses lived probably within shouting distance of each other. And most likely, their descendants probably had many other relationships, social relationships. They may have gone to the same church. And as it happens, I have some very distant relatives who have last names that are similar to Willoughby's descendants. So there could be a biological connection, but we're not exactly sure.
And those connections in that census data, of course, is after emancipation because there's, and that's your problem before. There's precious little data on enslaved people before emancipation.
Absolutely. Wow. If you look at census data in 1850 and 1860, you have the slave schedules, which basically are just rosters of slave owners, and they tell you the numbers of how many people they own. They don't tell you names. In fact, there was a big debate in the U.S. Senate about whether or not we should include names and other types of data on those 1850 and 1860 schedules. So you have to go first to the 1870 census, which is the first census where we see African Americans in freedom and if they own their own property and their own homes. And that's where we started.
Your family, your mother's from the Peedy region of South Carolina, is that right? How much did you know about your family history in that region before all of this?
Well, I have to say that, you know, this whole process has been a process of discovery, rediscovery of my own family. You know, every once in a while you have a side of your family you know a little bit more about, and then there's another side of the family you don't know as much about. And my mother's family was definitely the latter case. So I knew a little bit of family history, but I really, if you had gotten me 3 years earlier, I would not have known that James P. Daniels, that was the name of the slave owner who owned Moses. I would not have known that. I only knew that because my uncle, who's kind of our family historian, genealogist, had started to do research. And he had actually some of the James P. Daniels documents that the show used. He had them in his house, but I had never really spent time with them. And so this has been a wonderful learning experience. I do research on the state of South Carolina, but mostly in the upcountry, in the western part of the state. So this has kind of maybe turned my research agenda in a way that maybe fruitful in the future.
Where, what part of the state is the Petey region?
The Petey region is in northeastern North Carolina. For people who are North Carolinians, if you go south of Lumberton and south of the border, you will come into the Petey region around the Petey River.
Northeastern South Carolina.
Yes, yeah. Northeastern South Carolina. And it's an area that there are very few people who actually do research about it. People tend to do South Carolina Lowcountry, I think largely because they want to go to Charleston, and people tend to do the upcountry, the western part. But there's kind of a vast middle of South Carolina that doesn't get enough scholarly attention.
Well, all of this turned on this discovery of the bill of sale. Here's, and of course the program is History Detectives. Historian Eduardo Pagan is looking at this bill of sale in the program that airs tonight. And let's listen to this clip.
Oh my gosh, this is it. What it is recording is disconcerting, to say the least. This is about the sale of another human being. This is from the state of South Carolina. It's clear that Asa Brown, for $335, is selling to Stephen McWhite, a Negro girl aged about 17 years named Willoughby.
How significant is this document? Again, there's no connection. You haven't linked Willoughby to your family at all, but it's in a region, and you're starting to think more deeply about your own connections to this place. If you see a document like that, as a historian, you come across them all the time. Did it change things for you to look at this thing in this other context?
Well, you know, I mean, bills of sale are not totally common, but they're not rare either. I mean, if that makes any sense. And 1829 is pretty early for these, but it certainly changed my desire to go back in history. I am a historian of the late 19th century, but I keep creeping back. And it just really makes it clear to me that I think Faulkner once said something like history isn't even past, and that we can really reach out and touch history in this document, but I could reach out and touch it in my own family stories. And I think what's the beautiful thing about this document is that, in thinking about Willoughby's story and Moses' story as well, is that we can see all the changes that are happening in American society in the middle of the 19th century. We see a young woman who is sold to another slave owner. Then we can see her in the census data being married, having her children, being a landowner. We can see my ancestor going from slavery, being hired out to other people while he's enslaved. We see in 1857 in a document that's also on the website that he's passed through a will to a descendant of James P. Daniels. And then we see him in around 1870, owning a sizable portion of land in South Carolina. And eventually, he is eligible to be a juryman. And that means he's basically going to sit on local trials, which is not an insignificant thing in the 1870s. And so there are a lot of things that were possible in the 1870s and late 1860s for African Americans. And we tend not to think about that if we're not historians. But it was an incredibly dynamic time. And so many of the things that happened today really happened because of what happened in the 19th century.
Well, I was going to say, if you are studying the late 19th century, then you're looking at the beginnings, really, of Jim Crow as an institution. So looking back at a time when African Americans were serving on juries and were able to own land and begin to gain some economic independence as well, must be a fascinating glimpse for you.
It is fascinating because I really study the history of disenfranchisement, which really starts to happen incrementally in the 1880s, but really becomes a juggernaut in the 1890s when South Carolina, for instance, disenfranchises black males, rewrites its constitution to ban interracial marriage and all sorts of other things. But the moment where we see Willoughby and Moses in freedom in 1870 is this time where South Carolina, the majority of its legislators are African American. And the political landscape looks so different. So in 2012, you know, we've come off of an election where we have our black president again. But if we go back hundreds of years, there were black legislators, and not just in the South Carolina State House, but also in the U.S. Congress. The power situation looked so different, and African Americans had a voice right after the Civil War. Imagine being a slave and then being on a jury, or in some cases being a legislator. But then there are also people who, you know, just went through the everyday transition of being an enslaved person and then having to become a wage laborer and negotiate sometimes with the people who enslaved you for your living and livelihood.
How would you do do that. And yeah, again, those relationships, renegotiating those relationships, understanding yourselves now in a different position socially, politically. Did you, and you're a professional historian, or you're certainly well on your way to becoming a professional historian. So I suppose you're not supposed to immerse yourself in the story too deeply while you're analyzing some of these documents. And yet here you are in your family's, ancestral ground. Did you find yourself trying to fill in the blanks? Did you find yourself writing the novel of their story?
Of course. Well, and before I went to history graduate school, I was a journalist, so
You know how to fake things up.
Yeah, and I know how to make a story sound good, I think. So within the facts and the sources. So, of course, I think we all have imaginations, and this is a story that really fired my imagination. I realized, though, as a historian, that all the questions I had, that we probably wouldn't be able to answer them with the sources we have. But that's kind of the adventure of the profession I've chosen, which is that I don't always necessarily expect answers, but I expect questions that will lead us to some other place. And that's certainly what happened here. And it led me to think about more deeply about the Reconstruction moment right after the Civil War and what some historians call the failed revolution. So we can see in 1870 it's possible for Willoughby and Moses to be landowners, but we can see in 1900 that things have changed in the blink of an eye.
Talk about those sources. We've talked about a couple commercial documents, obviously, census data. Any kind of oral history, or what were some of the other other documentation or data that you used to tell the story?
Well, one thing that you don't see on the show, if you get a chance to watch it, is that the show was able to trace some of Willoughby's descendants. They decided, for whatever reason, not to participate in the show, and I think that was possibly because of distance. They didn't live nearby. But I also think there's probably some residual discomfort with talking about slavery. And also, a lot of the historical record tracing we did was through land. And if you think about the history of land and dispossession that happened all over the American South, it's certainly kind of a sensitive issue. We're very lucky in my family in that we still own some of the property that Moses Daniels had acquired sometime in the 1860s or 1870s. And but there were so many changes that South Carolina was an incredibly exciting place to live in, but it was also really dangerous. And the documents that we used largely were probate documents, which are things that come from somebody's will or their estate. And so in addition to the census data, we looked at the James P. Daniels estate. So there are inventories of things they bought and sold. And some of those things were just like a wagon or wood. But some of them also represent the fact that they sent my ancestor out to work on someone else's farm as a laborer. And we did look at his will, and we saw that in 1857, when James P. Daniels died, Willoughby, Moses, and about 9 other slaves were transferred, and we can see their value. So 1857, my ancestor was valued at about $1,000, and there were other slaves on that list who were anywhere from $200 to $700. I think Willoughby was about $400.
You talked about the understandable difficulty that people have in talking about the slave period and the fact that their ancestors were among these people and putting dollar values on their lives. It's understandable. What's the impact, do you think, of that on history and on us today, this point in history that we're not able to talk about as deeply as perhaps we should?
Well, I thought about it, and I can say, as a historian and also as the descendant of enslaved people, that, I feel no shame in that history. I think the shameful thing is when we don't talk about it. And certainly my other side of the family, we grew up with stories of my great-great-grandmother who was emancipated and given 3 pots, and that's what her life and freedom was supposed to start with. We didn't have those stories on my mother's side of the family until now. Moses was the first ancestor, and remains the first ancestor that we know of on that side of our family. So as I said, in History Detectives, you hit this amazing brick wall in slavery, and you hope that perhaps you can find some documents like we did. But history and slavery still absolutely live. I think about it in that my grandparents knew people who were enslaved. And so I think we like to think that, well, that was all over in 1865 and the Civil War was over, even though there's some people who say we're still fighting the Civil War. But it has incredible resonance. It has resonance in, the fact that some people got property, some people didn't. Some people, were able to access political rights and some people weren't. And so this really kind of is the foundation, I think, of our contemporary U.S. politics and the way things are and how we think about race relations.
One of the stories that grew up around Moses was the fact that he may have been the son of James P. Daniel, the slave owner.
Yeah, we don't know. That's an oral history that has been passed around some places in our family. We don't really have any way to tell. And certainly Moses in the census, if you look, he's listed as black. Sometimes the census would list people as M rather than B, and that M would be mulatto. But that was basically based on what they thought they saw. And it could have also been based on what people in those communities knew. So we have no way of knowing, really. But, you know, we know that Moses somehow maintained relationships with the Daniels after slavery. And one of the interesting things to come out of the story is that my mother, who was actually at the taping as kind of my hair and makeup consultant, my mother was able to talk to some descendants of the white branch of the Daniels family. And so hopefully, I'm not sure that there will be like a family reunion, but hopefully I think we can kind of join forces and gather more information to provide a fuller picture of this place that we all come from.
So you talked about this whole experience being something that has caused you to rethink your area of study. What do you think? I mean, how might it change?
Well, I knew that I was becoming more and more enamored of the early 19th century. And so whenever I finish the dissertation, which will be very soon, let's hope, I'm thinking that I may be working on a history of the early lives and mid-19th century activism of independent black farmers in the PD region. And they actually become very important in the modern civil rights movement in the 20th century. And one thing to say about the PD region, no one knows very much about it, but we have some really significant cases that happened in the PD region. One of the counties nearby was home to one of the cases that got folded into the Brown versus the Board of Education desegregation suit. And my mother's hometown of Lake City, South Carolina, was a place that in the 1890s, the African-American postmaster was murdered by a mob. And at that time, because he was a federal employee, people thought that there was some hope that they could finally pass federal anti-lynching legislation. It didn't happen, ever.
Are you able to know whether these stories are all about, in other words, how particular are they to their region and how much of the story of the post-slave period can we tell generally from particulars like Willoughby?
Well, I think that we can tell a lot. I mean, I think that the PD is like every place unique, but in some ways it's emblematic of this process of change that's happening. So you have black men who are able to participate in the political process, and that happened in many places throughout the South. Now, it was kind of a historical honeymoon because very soon, around 1877 in South Carolina, that comes to an end through political violence, through campaigns that stopped African Americans voting, really a reign of terror. But the PD is emblematic in that it's a place of really rich African American culture. It's also a place of incredible racial violence. And I think that those two things are so embedded in American culture. I think we have to recognize the contribution of African American culture to what we believe the United States is. And we also have to think about our history of racism and racial violence if we really want to tell the American story.
Cynthia, thanks so much for being on the program.
Okay, thank you.
Cynthia Greenlee Donnell is a PhD candidate in American history at Duke. Bill of Sale on the History Detectives airs tonight, PBS, 8 p.m. Coming up next, a theater troupe that puts the audience in the show. Stay tuned.